visitor to UBC. He's an emeritus professor at UCLA. I've got his PhD with R.H. Bink, one of the star students way back in
61, 62, something like that.
Anyway, he's still going strong, and he's been working on a project with Zhang Mu and myself on embedding manifolds in certain small complexes. So he told the story.
Well, what a pleasure to be here. I've been retired. I haven't given a Blackboard talk for 3 years, so this is a nostalgia trip for me. And I've never had such interesting math to present anywhere before. I hope I have time to get this stuff across because it's really beautiful. I want to start with telling you about Poincaré's original mistake with respect to his famous conjecture. Henri Poincaré conjectured in 1900, I think it was, that every homology sphere was a real sphere. That is, a three-manifold that had the algebraic structure of the three-dimensional sphere then had the topological, was a topological three-dimensional sphere, that homology was enough to algebraically describe the three-dimensional sphere. I hope you all have some familiarity with homology theory. I want to restate this in a more convenient way where I puncture the sphere, because I think instead of talking about a three-dimensional sphere, I can't barely understand it, you can't see it in three space or anything, I'd rather puncture it and talk about a three-dimensional ball, which you get just by puncturing a three-dimensional sphere, removing an open ball from it, so it's now a manifold with boundary. You know, I draw your picture one dimension down where I take a two-dimensional sphere, very hard to see relative to a two-dimensional ball where you puncture this thing, just remove a little piece out of it, and now it becomes just a flat. So I want to restate this original erroneous conjecture of Poincaré in this equivalent setting and say his original erroneous conjecture was, I'll call it Poincaré's original conjecture, was that if we have a homology ball, that implies we have a three-dimensional, by which I mean a three-manifold with boundary, which has the same homology as a regular three-dimensional ball, which is to say the same homology as a point, which is to say trivial homology. It has trivial homology. That's enough to imply that it's a topological three-dimensional ball, that it's topologically equivalent to just a nice solid round three-dimensional ball in three space. Well, that was 1900, I think. I might be off by a year or so on these things. Well, then he realized he was wrong, that homology didn't do the trick in 1901. Does that seem right for dates? 1904. He realized he was wrong, and there's a counterexample, which this counterexample, pretty astonishing, I'll put an exclamation point in there, and his counterexample is commonly called the Poincaré, to give it some kind of long name, I would call it the Poincaré, since he invented it, dodecahedral homology ball. It's going to look at it algebraically in terms of its homology structure. It has the same homology as a point or a three-dimensional ball, and yet topologically it's very different. Well, it's this monstrous construction. I want to show it to you quickly for those who haven't seen it because it's brilliant. Don't ask me how he thought this up. Group theory. I'm sure group theory was thinking of rigid motion. You start with a dodecahedron. You know, everybody know what a dodecahedron is? This thing has gotten a little battered in transportation, but it has 12 pentagons on it, right? And it has all these rigid motions on it, and it's very beautiful. And you make lampshades out of this thing. It's just 12 pentagons scotch taped together, six and six, Okay, so here's Poincaré's original construction. Is how do you make some exotic three-dimensional manifold out of this? Here's how you make before you puncture it. This is what Poincaré, he was working with spheres, not balls. So this is before you puncture it. You take this thing solid. The inside is solid. Okay, this is just filled in. It's a solid object, three-dimensional object. And now you make identifications. Each pentagon is identified with the pentagon on the opposite side. Okay? There are 12 pentagons. You're going to identify them in pairs and sew them together so that this face is gone because it's going to be sewed on to the face over on the other side. Well, there's a lot of trouble to this if you made this out of glass, this model out of glass, and you stared through, you'd see that the pentagon on the front and the pentagon on the back, when you line them up, they don't match. You're going to have the pentagon on the front looking like this, and the pentagon on the back that you're looking at is like that. So you have to make some kind of natural rule for how you make this identification, like always take the one closest to our eye and turn it clockwise by 1/10 of 360 degrees. Is that going to be 36 degrees? And then you'll get a match. That's the rule that Poincaré used. Now you have to check that this rule is consistent, that if you look, if you make that identification from side A with side B, then when you turn it around and look the other way and make the identification from side B to side A, you get consistency. You know, you have to check this rule for consistency. Here's, and that it all, that all these 12, you have six pairs, then that these matchups all work and produce a closed three manifold, and that three manifold has the homology of a sphere. And now I want to puncture this thing, so I'm going to make this identifications and then remove a little piece out of the very middle, remove a little ball out of the very middle. So I'll make the same identifications, but I'll be starting with not a solid object, but an object that is solid except for it has a hole in its very center core. That's the puncture. That's this object I'm talking about. Well, that's one way to look at it. Here's another way to look at it is, here's two more ways of looking at it. My handout sheets have gotten a little battered here, but I'm going to just pass you out two other ways of looking at it. This is some violation. This is paper waste. Paper waste. Okay, we'll see how it goes. Hey, this background introduction to what I'm here to talk about is much more interesting than what I'm going to really get to. So you should pay attention to this introductory background. Is all the really good stuff. So this is two different ways. That's it. Okay, I've given you two different ways of describing more explicitly this Poincaré construction. The first one is out of Seifert and Trefoil, and that is you take the dodecahedron and you try to draw it in some flat way. You flatten it out on the blackboard so we can see what's going on better than the real three-dimensional way I just showed you, and you get the following picture. Here's one of the pentagons. Well, then you need, here's five more, is six. Well, then you keep, I don't need to redraw for you this picture. Altogether, there are 12 pentagons pictured here in this figure. You can see the outer pentagon is the whole outside of the paper, you know, because you're flattening down some round thing into some flat thing. So there are 12 pentagons in the picture. And the identification is explicitly put down here, so you can easily check rigorously that you do get actually a three manifold and make all calculations of what its fundamental group is, what its homology group is. That's all in cipher and trefoil, so that's the first reference. The second picture is out of Dale's book, which is a construction of Dane that gives you the same homology sphere in a much easier way, or homology ball is what I want to make it into. Homology ball. This is a construction of Dane in which you start with a cube, a solid cube in three space. Then you drill a knotted hole through it using the simplest possible knot that you can use. Namely, I take a cube with a trefoil hole drilled through it, the minimal knot that you can use. Now,
up there, how do you drill a hole like that?
It's very hard to do this mechanically. It's good to just have a worm, a trained worm, and that drills through and out the bottom, and then you get your cube. So this is a cube with a knotted hole, and then now we're gonna kill the homology, but not in the obvious way. The obvious way would be to just say, let's sew a cap right across that hole up there. That would give you just a regular three-dimensional ball. The minute you fill in this hole with a little two-handle you want, or fill in just the top of that hole there, and we've recreated just a regular old three-dimensional ball. Dane said, instead of sewing it in that way, if you take, instead of an annulus that runs naturally once around the hole, if you take an annulus that runs once around the hole and once through the hole, and you sew, that's what's pictured here in the second page, is how this annulus should run. When I say run an annulus once around the hole, I know how to do that. I'll do it right on top like this. But when I say run it once around the hole and once through the hole, you try figuring out which annulus goes once around the hole, once through the hole. It's very confusing. That's what this picture shows to you. That's something I've hated ever since graduate school. It looks like Dale's drawn the wrong annulus here, and it takes some work to show it's the right annulus. Of course, when you take this weird annulus that runs something like this, and trying to draw this picture that you already have, once around the hole and once through the hole, and you try to sew onto this annulus, you're abstractly going to sew a thickened disc onto this strange annulus that goes not just once around the hole, but once around it and once through it. You can't do that in three-dimensional space. It's an abstract construction that's going to take you out of three-dimensional space. That also gives you this same Poincaré homology ball. Very hard to see. So, here's the big point of where the theory takes a trick, greatly simplifies this theory, a trick unknown to Poincaré, of course, I believe, which is the theory works better if you don't use homology, but you use homology with rational coefficients. When I say homology, that usually people mean by that homology with integer coefficients. This is always, although I didn't bother to say it, it's just sort of presumed when you say homology ball, everybody wants to use the homology with z coefficients. But here's the trick, is the theory goes much better if you use rational coefficients, use homology with rational coefficients throughout instead of z coefficients. What does that do to use rational coefficients? It means if you look at the regular Z homology and you get some homology group, let's say you have some object and the first homology group of your object is something that's going to have a bunch of Z. Typical homology group is a bunch of integers and then it's a bunch of finite parts. It has a finite, the torsion part, it can have Z2s and Z5s. That's the regular homology group. The integer, using integer coefficients just means we throw away all these finite cyclic groups with rational coefficients, I mean. Using rational homology says a homology now with rational coefficients, which I indicate by Q to stand for rational coefficients, means throw away all the finite part. Ignore it. Just stick to this part. Well, this is a very uncomfortable wrinkle in the theory. Why should this make the theory easier? I want to show that, try to justify why this trick is good, because this seemed to me very unnatural. I'm used to use homology with Z coefficients, not with Q coefficients. Why do it? Well, the first thing I want to show you is if you look at Poincaré's original conjecture with rational coefficients, then you get an easier counterexample. So the first advantage that I can point to, advantage one of rational coefficients, is now instead of getting a counterexample to this original conjecture of Poincaré with this horrible dodecahedral construction, you can get away with much easier counterexamples. We get, which are the punctured Lenz spaces. The punctured Lenz spaces now are also counterexamples. Well, we have a slew of these punctured Lenz spaces, and they're much easier to understand than this dodecahedral construction, which is such a tiger of a construction. So I want to tell you what the punctured Lenz spaces are. You can't see them. They don't exist in three space, so it takes a little bit of imagination. You start out with a solid torus. Solid. Let's call it T3. And the punctured Lenz space, L, PQ, I want to put punctured here. The punctured Lenz space, L, PQ, is obtained by taking a solid torus, taking on the boundary of the solid torus an annulus that goes around P times around one way and Q times around the other way. I better say what I mean one way and the other way. It goes P times around the solid torus. Let me draw for you the punctured Lenz space L21. That's the simplest one. Here's a 2-1 annulus. It's going to go once around, now twice around the solid torus this way. Now it's going to go once around the back to get back to where it started. I've only drawn it as a chalk line. I want it to be a little annulus, so it has fatness all the way around. Okay, I fatten it up to a little annulus. So I have a solid torus, P3, three-dimensional solid torus. On the boundary, I have this annulus which wraps around twice this way and then once the other way. And now I sew onto this annulus, I sew a thickened two-dimensional disc. Here's my sixth thickened two-dimensional disc. And I'll identify the boundary of the two-dimensional disc with this annulus. So this is our two-dimensional disc. If you sew a two-dimensional disc cross I onto this solid torus, that gives you a punctured Lenz space, the punctured Lenz space L21. Well, you can also get punctured Lenz spaces of all higher numbers, but if you calculate the fundamental group of this, or the first homology group of this thing is what I'm really interested in, you're going to get the first homology group is Z2. So if you use Z homology, that Z2 shows up and says this is not a legitimate, this is not homologically trivial, but if you're using rational homology, you ignore these finite parts, and this qualifies, therefore, as being homology ball. So punctured L21, which I've drawn here as a Q homology ball. And then you can also do the same construction with wrapping around three times this way and once this way, or any higher number, so you get a whole slew of examples. None of these examples exist in three space. In fact, I want to state that as a theorem. The starting point of this theory says Poincaré was not so dumb when he tried to use homology and failed, because at least he was correct. If you stick to three space, if you stay within the confines of three space, then his original erroneous conjecture was correct in that restricted situation. I'll call this a folklore theorem, because I don't know, I've never seen it in print, really. It's just everybody seems to know this, which is in three space, Euclidean three space, are three. Every homology ball is a ball. In other words, all these examples, this very difficult one of Poincaré, the dodecahedral example, or these punctured Lens spaces example, all of them live outside of three space. You can't take any of those examples and fit it into three space. In three space, if you know you have some three manifold with boundary and has trivial homology, you can show it's just the three-dimensional ball. You don't see any of this bad stuff. I think this is what Poincaré had in mind when he originally made his erroneous conjecture. He saw that at least it works in three space. It gives you some kind of start. How do you prove this folklore theorem? Everybody has a different proof.
Didn't Alexander really prove that?
It's Alexander's theorem. I agree. That's a good. If you have to point to a reference, you'd say it's Alexander's theorem.
In the 20s?
I don't think he ever stated this way. Okay, here's the question I want to raise, though. I'm making a point about why we don't want to use regular homology. We want to use homology with rational coefficients instead of Z coefficients. So I want to examine this folklore theorem. The way I stated it here, I presumed that you all presumed that I meant Z homology. Because that's what people mean when they just say homology. They always mean Z homology. But I want to say that the theorem is also true with Q coefficients. You have your choice. It's true both ways. So if you think that Alexander proved it, then he certainly didn't. He didn't prove it for Q coefficients. I don't know the history of this, but where they are. He didn't have any awareness of that type of.
The boundary is a sphere.
The boundary is a sphere, and you're home free. Okay, but here's my question: is which folklore theorem of these two that I've now given you is the stronger and better theorem? Is it better to realize that in three space every Z homology ball is a regular real three dimensional topological ball, or is it better to know in three space every Q homology ball is a topological ball? Which is the stronger theorem of the two? Well, the answer is, see, my point is it's better to use Q homology, so that should, just from a test-taking point of view, you're supposed to intuit that I'm pushing Q coefficients. It's a better theorem with Q coefficients. So I want to explicitly state it that way. As a justification for these rational coefficients, every rational homology ball is a ball in three-dimensional space. Why is that better? Because that gives you the extra bit of information that all these punctured Lens spaces do not go into three-dimensional space. When you look at these punctured Lens spaces, they don't qualify as homology balls if you use Z coefficients. They do qualify as homology balls if you use Q coefficients. So if you use Q coefficients, we get a better theorem. It excludes, in addition to everything else that Z coefficients excludes, it also excludes all these punctured Lens spaces. Okay, well, there's sort of the background on why punctured lens spaces are interesting to us. They're simple examples of homology balls if you're willing to use Q homology, which seems to make the whole theory much easier to understand. Now I switch the topic to some results about punctured lens spaces. As I said, this folklore theorem says none of these punctured lens spaces live in regular three-dimensional space. They're all abstractions. You have to look out into something bigger than three-dimensional space to get them in there. So the question is, where do they fit into? Do they fit into four-dimensional space, for example? Do they fit into five-dimensional space? So here's the results on that. First of all, a theorem of Epstein. Says that there are two theorems here which distinguish between the behavior of the odd punctured lens spaces and the even punctured lens spaces. This seems like some amazing theory. The punctured lens spaces all seem the same, but what do we mean by the even punctured lens spaces? And the odd punctured lens spaces. Even punctured lens spaces, the prototype is punctured L21. Punctured L41, etc. It's punctured L, and then you start with an even number. Then what about the second number? You don't care what the second number is.
But
you got to be careful. It has to be relative prime punctured. These lens spaces get very tricky very quickly. You got to be careful. Like punctured L42 doesn't exist. It can show that these numbers have to be relatively prime, because if you go P times around the torus this way and Q times around the torus this way with a simple closed curve, you can only make that construction if P and Q are relatively prime on a two-dimensional torus. So let me get this off the blackboard, this abomination. Now you can try to make out a list. Now there's all kinds of questions which abound, like is punctured L41 the same as punctured L43? I don't know the answer to that, but I'm sure it's known and all the experts know, but it gets very complicated. And these, for instance, anybody know the answer to that?
They're
homeomorphic?
They're homeomorphic, but with reversed orientation.
Reversed orientation.
L43 is the same as L4 minus 1.
There you go. All right. Okay, odd punctures, lens spaces. Of course, I mean punctured. Our prototypes are punctured L31, punctured L32. Don't be fooled. Punctured L31 and punctured L32 are also homeomorphic. It's one of those crazy things it takes. I'm not going to prove that for you. Well, here's the way the theorem works, is that the even punctured lens spaces don't fit into four space. That's what Epstein proved. The even punctured lens spaces do not differentiably embed in four space. Then Christopher Zeeman, proved around the same period of time, this was all done in the mid-60s or something, Zeeman proved that the odd punctured lens spaces all do fit into four space. And in fact, they do differentiably. This is all a differentiable theory. So, What about five space? In five space, everything fits in because all you can take any three manifold with boundary, whatever, and embed it in five space. There's just tons of room. The problem becomes uninteresting. Or I'm interesting, but I'm not going to get into that because I got enough to deal with here. So I had a folklore theorem that you can't get any of the punctured Lend spaces into three space. In four space, you can get in the even ones and you can't get in the odd ones. You go up to five space and everything fits in. There's the whole theory of punctured Lend spaces. I looked at this and thought, like, how do you get those odd punctured Lend spaces into four space? How does Eamon do that? So I read his paper a million times and still didn't understand. He takes a knot in three space and he turns it in four space, and as he turns it, he also twists the knot so it goes around, right? And he does some vibration. I don't understand that paper of Zeeman, so I've always wondered, how do you get... I looked at the easiest punctured Lend space, the easiest odd punctured Lend space that exists, namely punctured L31. I thought, there's something that's really understandable. And I tried to fit it into four space for, you know, a million hours, the way you work on a problem like this. I couldn't ever get it and couldn't understand Zeeman's paper and gave up on ever understanding it. Thought, just going to elude me for a lifetime. Well, Dale and Zhangmu and I have been working out theory of embeddings of punctured Lend spaces only. No, we don't talk differentiably, like these results are all differentiable embeddings that we're talking about here, these classical results, and we're trying to develop a parallel theory for piecewise linear embedding properties of the punctured Lend spaces. And we find that, as one would expect, the piecewise linear theory follows this along the same as the differentiable theory. But the piecewise linear theory, I think, is nicer. You can get a sharper delineation of what's going on. For instance, our theory yields, in place of Epstein's theorem, so this is all my differentiable blackboard with classical results for differentiable embeddings of punctured Lend spaces in four space. For the PL theory, piecewise linear theory, we have a parallel theorem to the theorem of Epstein, which says the even punctured Lend spaces do not embed in the cone over a planar graph crossed with an interval. What is this? This is supposed to be some very simple three-dimensional subset of four space. In place of four space, we have this object here, which is a 3D subset of four space. How can you see that? You take a planar graph, put it in the plane. Take the cone over a planar graph, and you have an object which is now in three-dimensional space. Cross it with a unit interval, and boom, and it goes in a very natural way into four space. So this is some specific three-dimensional subset of R4. In fact, this theorem is an if and only if theorem that the even punctured Lend spaces do not embed in the cone over a planar graph cross I, and if you use a non-planar graph, then the even punctured Lend spaces all do embed. I'm not going to get into that either. And I'm not really... This is... My warm-up is this analog of Epstein's theorem in the PL category. What I'm really interested in is an analog to Zeeman's theorem in the PL category, which I had this all wrong. I thought that Well, I won't even tell you in which way I had it all wrong. Zhang Lu sent me this example in December to show that the odd punctured lens spaces do, if embed PL, in, now in place of four space, I'm going to give you a specific three-dimensional subset of four space, namely, it's going to be a planar graph, and here's what the planar graph is. It's K5 minus a single edge. How do I draw you a picture of this thing? Here's what it is. This is K5, the complete graph on five vertices minus one edge. You know, K5 is non-planar. It's a non-planar graph. The complete graph on five vertices, where you take five vertices and you put an edge between every two vertices, gives you a basic one of the two basic non-planar graphs. This is K5, where you throw away one edge. Which edge have I thrown away? It's the edge that would go from the bottom vertex here to the top vertex here. If I try to put that edge in, I'd have to have a crossing. It would have to have a crossing. This is a non-planar graph, K5, but I'm allowed to discard that one edge. Here's our example of this is K5 minus an edge. It does fit into the plane because we've thrown away this one extra edge. And Zhang Mu Li sent me this manuscript back in December proving that the odd punctured lens spaces all embed piecewise linearly in this specific subset of, in this particular, what do I want to do? I want to take this graph and plug it in here. I've described what K5 minus one edge is. Now I want to say they do embed in the cone over this graph, K5 minus one edge cross I. Well, this is all research in progress, so this is all a big mess, and I don't know what to tell you quite next, except that I worked on this a while and got some improvement, I thought, in Zhang Mu's methodology, or simplification of his methodology. I just, you know, gave the paper due diligence like a referee does. You know how sometimes you can get a paper back from a referee with some comment which is anonymous, the referee's anonymous, and you see that this referee really read the paper. It's always amazing, you know, shows insight into the... You think, like, God, it's a miracle. This referee really paid attention to the paper. Well, I read Zhang Mu's paper with that type of diligence and got what I thought was an improvement. In fact, so I thought I got the same result for K5 minus two edges. I thought I was able to throw away this edge and get a better result that we could use K5 minus two edges. Well, this might seem like a quibble, but this is getting very finely tuned, and I was really pleased with this. Now, Zhang Lu tells me today that he agrees with my argument for K5 minus two edges. But unfortunately, when the argument for K5 minus two edges isn't going to work for all the odd punctured lens spaces, it's going to only work for some of the odd punctured lens spaces. Namely, all the basic ones, L31 punctured, works for. L32 punctured, it works for. L51, it works for. What's the first one that this argument does not work for? I don't even know. I was still fooling around with it, so I'm going to try to retreat to something solid where I think I know what I'm talking about, which is I'm going to try to show you now that Zhang Mu's construction, as I modified it, for only for embedding the punctured lens space L32 star. I'm willing to quit with that because in terms of the whole development of the theory, just a single odd punctures lens space that does embed here is all I really wanted, so I'm happy with it. And until we get this more thoroughly researched out, I just can't say more definitively about what happens to the rest of the odd punctured lens spaces. But I wanted to show you this great construction of Jean-Luc because it's very enlightening, aside from punctured lens spaces. Just a beautiful... It gives a lot of insight into some interesting topology. So here's my goal. The punctured lens space L32 can be placed piecewise linearly into the cone this particular graph, which I've pictured for you, cross I, a three-dimensional subset of four space. Well, I wish this thing, is there a graph theorist who can tell me how to name this thing in some decent way? What do you call this thing? I call it a wheel with four spokes, But I don't think any graph, you won't see that in any graph theory textbook, I guess maybe I should have drawn it piecewise linear. I should have drawn it as this would make graph theorists a little happier where I didn't have curved lines in it, maybe, but I don't know exactly in terms of nomenclature how to name it. So this is some killer construction. What made me happy is this takes care of what I was struggling with Zeeman's old paper. I couldn't see how to place an odd punctured lens space in four space. And this clearly puts it into four space because it puts it into this three-dimensional subset of four space. So it's sort of, in that sense, showed me not only how to do this, but what Zeeman was doing back in 1965 when he was spinning and twisting knots in four space in a way I couldn't understand. Well, so how are you going to do this? Here's Jean-Luc's basic idea as I see it. What's the state of... We went a little crazy on the Xerox machine today. Is this the one? No, this is the old... Oh, we didn't... Those new pictures, we didn't reproduce. Okay, I'm going to make a drawing for you.
I can run them off.
No, I don't need it. I can just...
How many copies did you make?
No. Today's one. That's all right. Let me try making a drawing for you to show you the basic idea of this. First, I'm going to put a picture into the plane for you. I want one picture of that thing. Jean-Luc's latest... Yeah, I'll put this on the board and then give it back to you. I want to make sure to get it right. God, this thing is a monster. I guess I want a lot of room. I keep getting nervous about my picture isn't big enough. Okay, I'm going to put 5 points. This is just the blackboard, two-dimensional space. I put 5 points here along the x-axis and another 5 points here along the x-axis. And I'm going to connect these 3 points with the left 3 points over here. And now I'm going to connect these 2 points with just This is in the upper half plane. I'm drawing you a picture. Now in the lower half plane, I want to take the center 3 to the center 3. Now I want to fatten this up so it's an annulus in the plane. Well, I'll start fattening it up. I'm lazy. Is that enough to give everybody the idea we fatten it up to it? It's not quite an annulus yet, because we now will finish it off in three-dimensional space. Here's the easiest way to finish it off in three-dimensional space is I'll put behind the blackboard, I'll finish off my annulus like this. There it goes. And it comes around like this behind the blackboard, and then the same thing over here. Behind the blackboard. Okay, so I now have a picture of an annulus that lies on the plane of the blackboard and also behind the blackboard.
I'll run up some copies and pass them out.
So this annulus never goes in front of the blackboard in three space. It's only on the surface of the blackboard and goes behind the blackboard. Now I'll just call this an annulus in three space. And now I'll redraw, they'll call this picture 1. And over here I'll redraw picture 2, which is the same picture exactly, except this time I'm going to have one of these connections go behind the blackboard and this other one go in front of the blackboard. One goes each way. Well, I'm certainly not, because of time constraints, not going to draw that for you. I'll just can I do some kind of gibberish drawing and say it looks the same, except one of these things goes behind, and on this one over here it goes in front. I could just change all these crossings. There's picture 2. I've just changed picture 1 into picture 2. Okay? In picture 2, this two-dimensional annulus lies on 4 different pages. It's on the blackboard, and it goes behind the blackboard, and it goes in front of the blackboard. Now I've really messed myself up in terms of continuing this lecture. I'll go, where's picture 1 and picture 2? Picture 1 was everything was behind. All right? Here's back to picture 1. Oh, that's... Here's picture 1 is an annulus where the 2 last connections off the blackboard both go behind the blackboard. Picture 2, one goes behind and one goes in front of the blackboard. That's picture 2. So we have 2 different ways of embedding an annulus in 3 space. Well, it's sort of the same annulus. It's just a question of, you know, how do you put these last connections behind the blackboard? Do they both go behind the blackboard, or does one go behind the blackboard and one go in front of the blackboard? It makes quite a difference in the characteristics of this annulus, because this annulus here if you put it in this way with both of these connections behind the blackboard is knotted and linked. The annulus is tied in some knot. If you check it out, just build it for yourself. Knotted and twisted. The annulus is knotted in an overhand knot, and if you check the number of twists, you know how to define twist of an annulus. You know, if an annulus looks like this, that's untwisted, but suppose it goes around and over, you know, I can build one for you easily, you know, as you go along it, suppose it goes Oh, if I had more drawing ability here, I wish I practiced this one. Spirals around, you know. This is twisted N times, where N is the number of little circles that you can barely see there. How do you define the twisting of an annulus? It's pretty obvious, maybe, for a nice round annulus like this. It's more complicated if you have some annulus that's also tied in some horrible knot in three-dimensional space. You can define the twist of an annulus as the, you look at the two boundary simple closed curves of the annulus, and you see what the linking homological linking number is of the two boundary components. Take the boundary of the two-dimensional annulus, and you have two simple closed curves, this one and this one, bounding the annulus as you go around, and you look at their linking number, homological linking number, which I won't define for you because it's too difficult. The annulus in my... Which one is picture in picture one? This annulus is both knotted and homologically twisted. The twisting number is 6. Each of these crossings is going to give you a plus 1. When you switch it to one in front and one behind, then the twisting number changes from 6 to 0. And the knottedness falls away as well. And in picture two, this example, the annulus is unknotted and untwisted. So what's the point? I wish I had a better picture of picture two, but I do have it, a better picture of picture two. Here's Zhang Mu's picture of picture two. Pass it around or something? Of our unknotted and untwisted annulus. So what am I saying? I'm saying take a book with 4 pages in three-dimensional space. That is to say, let me build it for you. You know, you take 4 pages and you actually stick them together, you bind them together. So we have 4 pages. Here's what I've drawn them. We have a page that goes to the right on the blackboard. Here's the binding right down this line in the blackboard. Two-dimensional page that goes to the left. A page that comes out of the blackboard at us, and a page that goes behind the blackboard. And we've built this complicated annulus on it, such that if you embed this book with 4 pages one way in three-dimensional space, this is what you get. If you embed it another way in three-dimensional space, this is what you get. The only difference being, what's the order of the 4 pages? Are the order of the 4 pages 1, 2, 3, 4? Or is the order of the 4 pages 1, some permutation on that? 1, if one of the books is put in the order, page 1, 2, 3, 4, and the other ordering is where... of course, we consider this to be circular, a book with 4 pages. The other ordering would be where the 1 is 1, 3, 2, 4. That's the only difference between these two pictures. Otherwise, in terms of the book with 4 pages, they're identical. It's only a question of in what order are the 4 pages placed in three-dimensional space. Okay, so how do we build an example out of this? Where's my book with 4 pages? God, look at this construction. I know you can't possibly get it because it took me 5 months of constant looking at it 4 hours a day to get this. So how can I explain it to you? Here's the four pages. 1, 2, 3, 4. See these four special vertices? I'm going to ignore the center vertex. I'm not considering now. I'm only considering those four vertices. If you take the cone over four vertices cross I, the cone over these four vertices around the circle cross I what do you get? This is a book with four pages. How do you see that? What's the cone over 4 points? The cone over 4 points is just... Here's the cone over 4 points. And now you take this cross I means... You take this one-dimensional graph and make it into... Take it cross I. I should have drawn it like maybe this. You're going to get... That's my end of trying to draw you a picture. Cross I, it's going to give you exactly a book with four pages. Okay? So we take this annulus on this book with four pages. First, we consider these four pages only as a subset of the outer circle. That puts them in one order, in that order I want to be this unknotted and untwisted order. So when it's unknotted and untwisted, that means you can take this annulus and put it onto a two-handle, put it on a pillbox, what's the technical, I would say, a disc cross an interval. If an annulus is unknotted and untwisted, when we put one page behind and one page in front, then we can place this annulus onto, it bounds a three-cell, lies on the boundary of a three-cell. In the book with four pages, cone of over the book with four pages, I don't want the cone over the book with four pages, cross I. That's half of the job. Now, that's what we embed in this circular part of this graph. Now, what about the cross in the middle? In the cross in the middle, what are we going to do? Start with the book with... We're going to take... We have four pages here, which are in my diagram indicated by just these 4 points. Really, it's the cone over these 4 points cross I. But I'll take, they are each symbolically, I can just view them as represented by these 4 points. Let's start with these 4 points. We can take the back page and the front page and swing them together into a new single page in the middle. We take the page on the that goes behind and the page that goes in front, and you just swing them together into a single page. That's what we did with the behind page and the front page to combine it to look like the other picture. What about the up page and the down page? We don't do anything with that. these two vertices, in other words, we do nothing with them. We just swing the behind page and the front page together so they're on some common new page. Now we say, use the rest of the picture. In the rest of the picture, we now have the other diagram. We now have this annulus in three pages, where the behind page and the front page have been swung into a common page, so the diagram now resembles this thing. This is knotted and twisted. Not only is it knotted and twisted, but it's knotted and twisted in a very special way. It's knotted and twisted exactly in the fashion of, if you take a solid torus in three-dimensional space and you take an annulus that goes around the boundary, an annulus that goes around the boundary in a fashion three times longitudinally and two times meridianally. That gives you a 3-2 annulus, which belongs to the boundary of our solid torus. If you take a solid torus in three-dimensional space and then you run an annulus around three times this way and two times the other way, and you look at it, you'll see that it actually is knotted and twisted, and in fact, it is, in this very configuration, this particular knotted and twisted annulus that I've drawn in this configuration can be placed onto a solid torus in three spaces, not just knotted and twisted, but it's knotted and twisted exactly as the annulus A32 is knotted and twisted here. Well, so then there's another difficulty that's talking about three space. We don't quite have all of three space here. We only have some little bit of three space. There are more technical difficulties that I think because of time and fatigue, I'm just not going to go into. I think that's deep enough into the technicalities of it. But to summarize, here's the basic idea of this construction is you want to get the punctured lens base, punctured L32, into this strangely configured object, the cone over this particular planograph cross eye. So you put an annulus into the cone over these key four points, cross I. Then you put half of your punctured lens space into this exterior part and the other half into the interior part by making a switcheroo from viewing the book with four pages going around in one configuration to the four pages going around to the other configuration. I'm sorry, I don't think this was a real satisfactory presentation of this stuff, but I'm warming up. This is my first practice. You know, this is very difficult to present. There's a lot of details to verify. But if you check the details, it's valid for embedding the punctured lens space L32. And Zhang Wu today has informed me that it works for L52, L72, L92. It seems to be all right for all the punctured lens spaces, odd punctured lens spaces, as long as we have a 2 here. But if you take some punctured lens space like L127, and if I put a 2 here, we're in the clear with this construction. And if we put some other number, we don't know whether it's valid or not. Is that correct, the way you see it now? Well, that's the fun part, is that we're thrashing along. Why is it that we're interested? It's all because we want to know more about homology balls and where they embed and where they don't embed. And in particular, homology balls using these rational coefficients so that these punctured lens spaces are our primo examples. And I wish I could show you more about where we want to go with this, but I think that's enough for today. I also think I wish I had better pictures and more time and could do this more justice, because it's some beautiful idea, and it can get so complicated looking, whereas it's really at the core of it lies this very simple idea of these two different ways of placing a book with four pages in three-dimensional space because of the ordering, and that's the, at the core of the whole thing.
So, before we ask the questions, are you going to give another talk today? Or?
I think that's enough, actually.
Okay. Questions?
Yes.
Dumb question from a non-topological self. When you were making that punctured lens space, you were gluing basically a piece of a round piece of something, like you had drawn like a cork. But
yeah.
I imagine it's sort of. You take the boundary of it. I see.
But I should have. Let me say what that is more clearly. Here's, we're gluing two objects together. One is a solid three-dimensional torus. T3, solid torus. The other is a two-dimensional disc cross an interval. Two-dimensional disc thickened up. I'm going to take the outside edge that goes around this thing, which is, this has so many different names, you know, so it's just an annulus naturally embedded on the boundary of a three-dimensional ball, or some people like to call it a pillbox, or
a two-handle,
or I don't know what. So they're both solid three-dimensional objects. We take this boundary annulus, A2, that just runs once around this pillbox, and we sew it onto some annulus on the boundary of this solid torus. But what annulus do you pick? If you pick the obvious annulus that goes real simple-mindedly once around the solid torus and zero times around the other way, and you sew it on, you just get nothing interesting. You get a regular three-dimensional ball out of this. But if you sew it in some exotic way in which you go 27 times around this way and 13 times around this way, then you get, by sewing this annulus onto the 27-13 annulus that circles around the boundary, don't ask me how to draw that one, but that would give you the punctured lens space, punctured L27, 13. I'm not interested, of course, in those higher ones. L2, punctured L21 and punctured L31 seems like enough for me. I should mention in passing, perhaps, if you want a little exercise, that punctured L21, on which you go two times around this way and once around this way. I think I actually tried to draw that for you earlier because that's a real easy low one. That's the same. This thing is the same as punctured real projective three-dimensional space. RP3. So the punctured lens spaces can be all viewed as generalizations of the simplest lens space is RP3, real projective three-dimensional space. And the lens spaces can all be looked at as starting with, if you think projective three space is interesting, then here's a way to look at a lot more examples of the same ilk.
So what I was trying to verify is that you take that band that's around this thing.
Yes.
The sides of the tuna can, so to speak.
Yes.
And you paste that onto, you realize that as your picture too.
Paste it onto the boundary of this.
No, but I mean now for this example, I mean for this theory.
Yeah.
So you take this band and
yeah, you realize it as picture two.
Picture two.
That's right.
Identify the two.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Because in picture two, the annulus is unknotted and untwisted, and that's the case with this annulus. The edge of the tuna can, as you can see, is also unknotted and untwisted, so that's picture two. Isn't that enough for one day? It seems like plenty of
I'd like to hear you state the characterization of planar graphs, which I believe.
Planar graphs. Okay, that's back to the Epstein, how the Epstein's result and how a graph is planar if and only if. Which way do you want to state it? Or a graph is non-planar if a graph G is planar. This is always a good start for a theorem because then there's a million ways to finish this statement. I'm told by graph theorists whenever I think I have some new one, a graph theorist say, oh God, it's already 10 million in the literature. What do we need your extra one for? But it's because we have the best new one, the best way to finish this sentence in our opinion. A graph G is planar if and only if punctured lens space L21. That's the simplest one you can have, the simplest non-trivial one. Does not embed in the cone over this graph cross an interval. That's one theorem that comes out of this. What? I don't know which way is easier to say it. A graph is planar if and only if punctured L21 does not embed, or to switch it around and say a graph is non-planar if and only if punctured L21 does embed. This way reads better for the first line, and then it reads all jagged here. If you state it the other way, I think a graph is non-planar if and only if punctured L21 does embed. Let's take it this way. Because now you can see what it says. If a graph is non-planar, it's sort of bigger than the planar ones are smaller. The non-planar ones are bigger. Right? So a graph is non-planar means it's one of those bigger graphs. It's a bigger graph. If it's a bigger graph, then the cone over this bigger graph cross I is big enough to fit punctured L21 into it. God, I don't know if that... Did that make any sense? Well, this theorem is just a mind-boggler to state and try to understand. And I wish I could say that it has astonished graph theorists around the world, but I don't think anybody's seen it outside of this room, so we haven't had a chance to even try it out yet on the graph theorists. But seems like some new interesting characterization. It gives information perhaps about planar and non-planar graphs, always a subject of great interest. And it gives information about embeddings of three manifolds, always a subject of great interest. And it hooks the two of them together in some mysterious way. And so it's something that we're all enthusiastic about. Although we don't fully understand exactly how it all works. But we have this characterization of planar and non-planar graphs. So, is this as beautiful as Kuratowski's characterization of planar and non-planar graphs? Kuratowski, what he says is that a graph is non-planar. If a graph is non-planar, it has to have one of two specific bad ones with it. There are two non-planar graphs. That's what Kuratowski's theorem says. Here's one of them, which is the complete graph on five vertices. K5. It's non-planar. No matter how you try to wiggle the edges, they're going to have crossings. The other one is K33, which says join. It's K33. Kuratowski proved, I don't know when, also around 1920? That's a bluff. 19-something. That these two graphs are non-planar, and any non-planar graph must contain within it one of these two. That these two graphs, that's it for non-planar graphs. Yeah, and if you take a graph and it doesn't have one of the two, two configurations in it, then it's planar. If it does have one of those two configurations in it, then it's non-planar. Well, that's a cleaner result to understand than this. So I really don't mean to say in any way that this is going to knock Kuratowski's theorem out of the ballpark.
Plus, we have to use
Kuratowski. Yeah. But nobody understood Kuratowski's proof of Kuratowski's theorem anyway. It was, or I could never understand it. There's a modern proof by Thomasson, some Danish guy that's very elegant and easier to understand. But people agree that Kuratowski proved that it was just some long-winded proof. But there are many, many theorems that begin a graph is planar if and only if, and then some exotic condition to follow. I'm told that this is some common format for planar graph theorems. Anything else?
Well,
thank you. Thank you.